this is Cindy F. Solomon with the Global Product Management Talk, coming to you today from the San Francisco Bay Area on April 12th. It is 1 o'clock p.m. my time, and I am delighted to have with us today Jesper Thompson, Copenhagen area startup in Denmark, Rooz, R-O-O-Z-Z.com. The Global Product Management Talk is a weekly broadcast on all things product management, and Startup Talk Radio is an audio feature where we talk to the people behind the startups and find out what makes them tick. Jesper Thompson is the Vice President of Sales and Marketing with Rooz, R-O-O-Z-Z.com. They were named the second most innovative tech startup on the planet out of 2,000 companies at the Global Tech Symposium. Jesper is a corporate guy who exchanged the safety and certainty of a big Danish corporation for the uncertainty, long hours, and awesome fun of being part of a small and great team that is working on changing how software is used. When he was starting out as a young management trainee in the Danish conglomerate Maersk, Jesper ended up working internationally for a total of 12 years within product management, operations, strategy, and business-to-business sales, and managing multi-million dollar P&Ls before making the jump into the unknown to join a fast-growing startup. We're honored and delighted to have you with us today. Jesper, what time is it where you are?
Thank you, Cindy, for having me. It is now 10:05 p.m. Copenhagen time.
I really appreciate your giving up your sleep to join us.
I'm just warming up. I have a conference call in 2 hours at midnight with a partner in Australia. So, you know, we're used to it.
People in startups are known to work 24/7, but getting your brain to be in gear during all of that time is a challenge.
It can be, yes.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you came to join this startup? Specifically interested in your background in product management. People are always interested in how do you become a product manager? How do you get into a startup? And what are those challenges?
Thank you, Cindy, for that introduction, which was quite spot on. And yes, I guess my background is a little bit unorthodox for really any startup and any startup environment. I actually joined the Danish company Maersk, the Maersk Line, the shipping company, the shipping division of Maersk, back in 1997 in Copenhagen as part of an international management trainee program called the Maersk International Shipping Education. Very, very good education where they took in 150 trainees from 30 different countries to work in the organization, brought them together, groomed them, and so on, as you do with people in that age. And then basically what took them through a two-year program, you worked locally in your organization at home in your local country, and then you met a couple times a year to go through the theoretical part of the education. It's a two-year program that then ended with expatriation.
So was that right out of college? How young were you?
I was 21 at that time, so it basically was right out of college.
Excellent.
Having finished the trainee program, I got expatriated to Tanzania in East Africa and spent 2.5 years there doing really a little bit of everything, dominant the operational focused jobs, but also a little bit of sales. And I then returned to Copenhagen to the corporate head office and they stayed a little bit longer in operations, in capacity management, sort of a liaison role between the commercial section and the operational section, and then moved on to the U.S. and was there for a year, expatriated there. And then I came back, and that's when sort of my product management career started. I had a job in sort of the engine room of Maersk Line, where the profit and loss responsibility lies, being involved in the trade between North America and the Middle East. And after that, I moved on to another geographical area, namely Asia to West Africa, with full profit and loss responsibility for a total of roughly 40 countries in this geographical area. So it was a great time. I absolutely enjoyed every moment of it, but there was also sort of this, how should I put it, this feeling that there was something else out there, of course.
Yep.
A very, very good company to work for, brilliant colleagues. I've been able to travel all over the world and deal with the whole world for many, many years, and that's been phenomenal. But there was also this sneaking suspicion that something else was out there, and I kind of wanted to, I was getting more and more intrigued as the years went by to see what it could be like to be part of something as different as this, and something ideally in IT. So I finally ended up leaving the company back in December 2009. I actually went back to school for a semester in Copenhagen Business School, took a couple of courses, was basically getting ready to take an MBA, and then I got the opportunity to then join Roos.
So you were actually looking for something different.
I mean, the startup thing was really, really intriguing. That's what I wanted to do. But missing maybe my own good idea and maybe not being entirely ready to start something myself, but rather than to join, I was actually looking at the thought of doing an MBA instead. So I guess it was a matter of perfect timing, really, because I got the opportunity to join this by the time I was actually talking to Copenhagen Business School about doing an MBA.
So how did you come to be the second employee?
Well, the company Roos was actually started, if I can turn time back a little bit, the company Roos was started by Thomas Petersen, another Danish guy, who is actually a software engineer, educated a software engineer. Had his own consultancy for many years, done consultancy work in software engineering, software development for a lot of big corporations. Yeah, a big Danish pharmaceutical company called Novo and a Danish oil company called Dong and so forth. A very experienced guy, been part of a couple of startups also before. But he had this frustration because he's definitely, again, he's a hardcore software guy, but kept being frustrated by the fact that if you want to use software, it is just not particularly user-friendly. I mean, if you think about it, apps have been amazing on the mobile phone. It's extremely easy. You press and the app basically downloads to your phone, and it's there. It's ready to use. If you want to watch a video on YouTube, it could not be any easier than it is today. It's not the same way with desktop software, which is very sure. I mean, there are great online options, and there are software as a service and so forth. But again, the vast majority of software is still used for the old-fashioned way, if we can use that phrase. I mean, you've got to go through the whole download process. You've got to download it. You've got to install it. You've got to click next, accept license agreement, sometimes restart your computer. And then when that has been done, you've still got to find the software somewhere on your desktop or your start menu or whatever it is. Where people are really more and more working is in the browser. So when you open your computer, you basically do that to be online. So why not actually just run it right in the browser? And another thing that is also a frustration, was a frustration to some and all of us, is that a lot of quality software costs a lot of money. And we understand why, but if you have a piece of software, for example, a photo editing application or video editing or a business application, you want to use one day here, one day there, why do you need to pay $50 or $100 for it? You simply end up not doing that. You end up using a trial version or freeware or something. So why not actually rent that software out? So again, when I went back to school and sitting there at night writing a paper on strategy, and I needed an application to a piece of software to help me with that as a model to put into my paper, I ended up looking for something free because I think the internet and privacy and everything else have made us very, very cheap. So people are reluctant to pay, and I must admit that also includes myself. But if that good application had been available to rent, run it in the browser, rent it for a day for say $5-6, I would have done that.
So Roos is essentially disrupting how software is being distributed. So currently, if you want to use software, you find it online, you try it out for 30 days. In that trial, you may have a dismantled version, a version with the watermark. So it doesn't have all the features available, but it's a teaser. So I think the idea of the 30-day was to get you to install it onto your computer. And once you had it installed, assuming you used it, you don't want to give it up, so then you're forced into paying for it because you've become dependent on it. So you're suggesting that instead of you give someone a puppy just to take home with them and then they don't want to give it up. So you're suggesting that instead of forcing people to take the download, that they could actually use a full version of the software immediately online without having to download anything onto their desktop.
To some degree, there's a little more to it than that, because the thing about the free trial is that you also find, I mean, what is the normal limit? It's somewhere between 15 and 30 days, sometimes even 60 days to try.
Right.
And you're right. A lot of them, you have like limited functionality, or you've got watermark, you know, when you print or when you do anything, for example. It's not, but you also have a lot of products that actually come completely without restrictions. And the problem is, you're right on the publish side to some degree, but the problem is that for most publishers that we talk to, this is in a number of different sectors, they say that people who actually end up buying the full version after having tried it is down to about 2 or 3%. So that's not a lot, because a lot of people end up actually saying, oh, this is a pretty good piece of software, I used it for a couple of days, it solved my problem. Or this is a pretty good piece of software, I used it, I want to continue using it, and I'm really sure I'm ready to pay $60 for it. Let me see if I can find a crack online. And that is, of course, the problem, right? That even otherwise honest people will unfortunately do that. I mean,
it's sure, especially if you only need it for one day or
exactly.
One task.
Exactly. And it's unfortunately so incredibly easy. I mean, anyone can find a pirated version of really any piece of software in a matter of 10 seconds Googling. The software industry has not really been successful in solving some of these pirate issues, and it's estimated it's costing around $60 billion a year. How accurate is that number? We don't really know, but that's sort of what the people who are experts, certainly more experts than we are, piracy of software, estimated to. So they're trying for many, many years to solve it by doing all sorts of technical things, but it's not really worked. So what we actually suggesting is also kind of a different way. So say if you had not been able to technically make it impossible for people to crack software and use pirated versions of software, maybe you should try something completely different. Maybe you should find a new model where you say, yeah, we admit that as an industry that there is a problem with piracy, and we realize that, and you know, it's probably futile to keep trying to improve security because there are a lot of very skilled hackers out there who are able to crack it. Maybe we should try a new business model. Maybe we could actually get customers, the people who would today use a free trial, the people who would use freeware, shareware, pirated software, the people who will use your competitors' free trial, maybe they would all of a sudden be actually interested in using your piece of software. They could just rent it for a day, run it without installation, and just run it in the browser, and, of course, access wherever they are through there, through the login ID. And that's, in essence, what we're trying to do.
Do I have to be pre-signed up with Ruse? So I find a piece of software I want to use, I want to rent. Do I have to come to Ruse to look at your software catalog? Or do I get it from the vendor site? Number one, it's where do I find that software? And then number two, what's the process? Is it like Google Docs where I have to sign into my Google account and then I can access it in the cloud? Or is it, do I have to be registered with that vendor? What are the steps to getting to where I want, which is the immediate use of that software?
Yes, very relevant question, Cindy. I mean, let me first mention that right now we have about 100 different titles on our platform, and that's in all sorts of software segments, photo video editing, sound productivity, as well as a bunch of different games. This is split between free titles, which are the predominant or the majority. We have about 70 free titles, and the remaining are paid titles. All those are available in the Google Chrome Web Store. They will also shortly be available on our Facebook page. And then what we are going to do as we add more titles to our platform is that we will work directly with the publisher to have them also help us promote it, so to speak. I mean, Ruse is not going to be a new download.com, for example, that have all pieces of software in the world and be the go-to. Because that's a long process.
Sure, they've been around for, yeah.
Yeah, they're doing it.
Around for, gosh, I remember them.
Yeah, I mean, download.com or anyone else.
Plus.
Exactly. And they're doing a very, very good job in that. But it's also realizing that that's quite a costly operation to try and sort of
sure, I'll be build the,
yeah, build the go-to, but just also build and market the go-to website. So we chose a little bit of a different structure. What we want to do is work with the publishers and jointly promote this. So we're going to keep promoting any title that goes online, for example, through Google Chrome Store, through our Facebook site, but also through the publishers. We prefer to work directly with the publishers because it's very easy for them to simply say, okay, so software company, you know, ABC Software, they have a site where they sell their software, a regular store. What they can then do very simply and easily, add a little bit of code to the site, and then they can add an event button. So when you as a user come in and say, okay, I have found this great piece of video editing software, I want to try that, you find that by Google, for example, and then we will take it to the publisher's website. It will also show up in your Google search result. You'll be able to find it in your web store. You will also be able to find it on our Facebook site and so forth. And where you will also be able to find, and that's very important to mention, is on different software download portals, because we are right now in discussion with several of those. We are actually expecting to go live within the next month or so with a download portal. We will actually add a dedicated vent button to the website. That's something that does not exist anywhere in the industry today. We are in talk with quite a few of them already.
So then you're not displacing how software is currently being distributed. What you're doing is adding another choice to the consumer.
Yeah.
Got it.
Our interest is not so much on the distribution side. We're not that worried about distribution. Of course, it's extremely important, but we're quite sure that once we, together with the portals, we are signing partnerships agreements with and the publishers, but once we start getting the message out there, it will get traction and people will come to know of it. And it will, in essence, be distributed, you know, the same way software is being distributed today. What is just a very, very big change, the entire user experience, and that whole new business model, and whole new opportunity for new revenue, new users, we bring to software publishers.
So that makes perfect sense for the legacy software that exists. And I have questions about how big that software can be that you can handle. So up until now, software has been being developed assuming a desktop environment. But gosh, in the past few years and going forward, and I'm in San Francisco, all the startups I see, they're developing purely for the web. They're developing an environment that they're not even expecting it to be a desktop. All of the mobile applications have a very light footprint. So are they not your market?
I think we need to distinguish. I mean, I guess it all depends on what kind of software companies you're talking about, Cindy.
Software that is web-based. It's made for the current user going forward, that there's no download. You can, the mobile applications, they're software that's intended to be used on a tablet, on a mobile device.
Right. Well, right now, I mean, Roos works for, we are Windows platform only. So we work.
Got it.
It works for all operating systems on the Windows and in all browsers. Firefox, IE, so forth.
So I guess that's what the question, that your market opportunity is all of the legacy, all of the software that has been developed up to now that requires a Windows operating system and a desktop environment.
Yes, exactly. I mean, after all, it's still, if I remember the numbers correctly, a little more than 90% of all computers out there, that's still a Windows PC. I mean, we, of course, very well aware that the tablet market is growing very fast. But we also certainly considering to make a tablet version. I don't think it makes sense to mobile phones necessarily, unless, of course, you pop that mobile phone and connect it to a keyboard and a screen and so on, because a lot of the software that we are, where it makes sense to run Roos, is sort of really traditional desktop software, where you need like a proper screen and keyboard and so forth. But that could be a lot of the software that would make sense on a tablet, but that's something we're looking at, and that's something that would very likely come next year.
Okay.
Right now, it's all the existing software. I mean, let me put it this way. It's a software that makes sense to run on Roos. There are certain types of software that don't make sense, and there are certain types that make absolutely perfect sense. And there are a lot of applications out there. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of applications that is basically, in essence, being used the same way as they always have. It's traditional download, run from your desktop kind of application. And the problem is that you're absolutely right. A lot of companies are programming for the web. But I think we need to keep one thing in mind. That is, it's still a very, very long process. And it's still a lot of very, very expensive programs out there that the software publishers would still like to see some revenue from. And taking an existing application and making that web ready is a very costly experience. We talked to customers that actually come to us and said, we would like to have our application on the web, and we actually programmed on it for more than a year and a half now, and now we committed to our customers, but it still doesn't work. So can we use Roos in the meantime?
Right.
And that's then what we do, because we can then, on average, convert it in 48 hours. We cannot convert every application. There are some that are not technically possible, but we can convert well over 50% of applications in the market today.
Because it would require a whole another set of developers to develop for the web, different from the ones who are developing for the desktop.
Yes, exactly. And again, if you want to reprogram an application, existing Windows desktop application run on the web, that is very costly. That's a very costly exercise and time-consuming, of course.
And so this reveals my blinders. I've just been thinking in terms of startups in San Francisco are all web-based and mobile-focused. So I forget that startups in other parts of the world have a much bigger focus. It's interesting that I caught myself in something that the whole purpose of this global talk is to shed light on the importance of the different environments. And as product managers, we get so almost tunnel visioned on what our environment is and what our market is that we lose sight of it. There may be much bigger markets, and the whole world is not necessarily operating with the same perspective.
So
let me step back to, we did skip over this. Tell me about the startup environment in Denmark.
I think overall the startup environment is quite healthy in Denmark, I would say. I mean, there are a lot of startups basically launching on a regular basis. There's a pretty healthy environment. Of course, Copenhagen is still a fairly small place compared to, you know, a lot of other hotbeds for startups anywhere in the world. But relative to its size, I think actually there's a pretty good selection of startups, and I think there is more and more becoming sort of a true startup environment, a true startup how should we put it, attitude.
Incubator,
I mean, also to some degree, or to I would say a big degree, sparked by the launch of the Startup Bootcamp program, which is actually the ones who were so kind to nominate us to participate in Global Tech Symposium. I mean, that was started in August 2010, and Russo was amongst the first 10 teams to join that program, and now it's spreading all over Europe. I think it's in 5 cities right now. Startup Bootcamp, I want to say like a spin-off of a Techstars incubator. It was actually started by a guy. Funny enough, we needed a foreigner to start this in Copenhagen, but kudos to him, a gentleman named Alex Farset, who is married to a Dane and been in Denmark for Copenhagen for many years. Actually just moved to Berlin a few weeks ago to do Startup Bootcamp down there. So that's quite cool. But he started that. I mean, he kind of realized that this could make sense. What he's seen makes sense elsewhere in the world could also make a lot of sense, a lot of value in Copenhagen. Because, again, the very famous or infamous story of two guys in a basement, you know, very often is true, that you are kind of left in the dark a little bit, and you are kind of left alone to some degree. But maybe if you actually took a bunch of teams and a bunch of skilled mentors together and just had like a hardcore 3 months program, that could actually help a lot of people get much further than they otherwise could. And that's what we initially signed up for, and we were selected as one of 10 teams to join, and we went through the program from August, November 2010. It was a very, very good experience. We were fortunate to have, basically, there were a new mentor coming in every day, one day talking about business development, one day about strategy, one day about marketing, one day about sales, and so forth. So basically, you kind of got this 360 coverage of all the issues that surround the startup, or really any business overall. So there's no doubt that we got more input, and we learned a lot more than we would otherwise have done in 3 months, not to mention the network that we actually got access to through the mentors and so forth. I mean, some of these customers that we actually have today are a direct consequence of the mentors making their networks available to us.
Excellent. So it's an accelerator.
Yes.
And then they also bring investors. I mean, that's the intention, to accelerate the startups so that investors can invest and everyone makes money.
Yes, basically. I mean, what you sort of work towards is the investor day, which is the last day after 3 months. And then everyone gets on the stage in front of, I think we had about 100 investors or so in Copenhagen. Kind of similar to Global Tech Symposium, get on the stage, pitch for 8 minutes, and then there's basically just networking, and you see if there's a match and with an investor. And I know that in our case, that actually did not lead to an investment like that, but we were so lucky that we got funded a little bit later, the following year, by Cheek Capital, the biggest VC in Denmark. For a number of our fellow companies there, they actually did get some money as a result of that. So that's really the idea. To get the word out there and get some much valuable feedback. And even if you don't get funded, it's still, of course, incredibly valuable to get on that stage and get the opportunity to get feedback from skilled and experienced investors.
And it raised visibility so that they were chosen by the Global Technology Symposium to come here and present.
Yes, exactly. We were nominated.
For Ruth to be chosen as the winner. And I think they probably should have awarded two. But also,
yeah, no, we didn't win Sunday, unfortunately. We came in second.
It was very, very close. But still, even to be the second most innovative startup on the planet has to be the utmost award.
It is. It still sounds pretty good. I agree. You're right. And we are certainly quite proud of that.
Excellent. Coming back to Ruth, the software that you have available now, can I assume that most software will be in all languages? So it's not an issue if they're not in English?
No, it's not.
Because all software is being developed for a global audience at this point.
Yeah. I mean, there's basically no, I think that's, I don't know, can I just mention just one thing about the sort of the technical side of the performance?
Please.
Okay, I think it's important to keep in mind that if you're trying to do something as we're doing, which admittedly is a little bit bold, we're trying to change our software developers and publishers. We're trying to change their business model, in essence. We're saying, don't sell software the traditional way, but the full price, go out and get access to this big group of people who would never buy your product at the full price, but actually would be interested in renting it. And do that by giving us your application, and we then turn it into a web solution. It's a fairly bold move. So the one thing we realized early on is that if we need to do this successfully, we have to make sure that the performance of the software, and of course it's software, I mean, some of the customers we have on board and we are talking to also has spent sometimes millions of dollars developing the software.
Of course, in years.
And years, right? So naturally, we need to have something that works. So it's essential that the performance of the given application is as good as it is if you run it the traditional way.
It should be seamless. The person who's using it shouldn't notice a difference at all.
No, except that it's more convenient, right? That should be a positive experience.
It should be a better experience.
Yes, it should be. So, of course, that's very important. That also means that what actually happens is that it executes off the client's machine. That means that any kind of software that you today would use as a desktop version and you need access to your C drive and your folders and whatnot, you will get that also using software rules. You just have the added advantage that you don't need to install it and that you can access it from anywhere through your login once you've entered the given application. But there's no performance hitch whatsoever. And it's one of the questions, I mean, it's probably, I would say, the first question you get from any software developer and publisher we talk to, saying, no, my application is very technically demanding and requires a lot of CPU power and requires access to graphic card and so on. And
they invested... That's right. That's where all their time and energy has gone into, making it complex,
yeah.
Adding all the features, and so that we haven't touched upon at all. It seems almost like magic that you can take any software and make it available without a download. It almost it might be insulting to the developer.
Yeah. So, I mean, it is a very sophisticated technology. I mean, what it does is a little bit like, say, another way. I mean, what you need to do is install a small plugin first. I think maybe we should just explain. I also think, actually, I think your question earlier, maybe I didn't answer that 100%, finding the software and so on, how it works. First time you access an application, you've got to install a plugin, which is also called the Root plugin.
So there is one install.
There is one install. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, that's a little bit cheating.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. It's a one-time thing.
It's one install. It's not install every time.
No, it is one-time install only ever, really. Any updates, of course, like any other plugin or any other, Skype also, I just said we had updated Skype before we started the call. We don't need to do that. We can update silently in the background. So once it's there, you will actually forget about it. But what you will then, of course, get access to is any application that we've got it.
How much space is required and what operating system is necessary? Would this work on older machines?
This works on Windows Vista and Windows XP and Windows 7, which is basically the vast majority of machines out the market today. And it works for 32 and 64 bits, and it works, again, for all browsers. So, you know, Chrome, Firefox, Explorer, whatever. And the way it works is that it caches a few files, the files that are necessary to actually execute the application on your C drive, and then it starts directly in the browser with the performance you would expect from the desktop version. I mean, it's that important. It is one of the things that we may incorporate legacy, but not a streaming solution. I mean, there's a company in the U.S. called OnLive, which has a very cool option that allows you to stream games and so on. Extremely hardware intensive and costly, but this is not a streaming solution. we take the files from our server. We use Microsoft Azure, which is extremely stable and secure. And then it basically just caches some files on your C drive, and then it starts running.
In terms of the cost to the user, is there a subscription fee so I can pay, like, Netflix, I can pay Ruse so much per month, and then I get unlimited access to the software catalog?
Nope, that is not exactly our model. It may be something that we could work on at a later stage, but right now we're actually doing something a little bit different and doesn't really exist in the industry. We believe in a rental model. So that means when you sit at home and you need to edit the pictures of your kids on a Sunday, for example, and you know, there are a lot of good applications out there for that, but you may not want to pay $50-$60 for that quality application, because you don't really need to edit that many pictures, you don't need to do that often. So instead you go in and rent. So you rent it based on what the publisher set up. So the publisher, the owner of the title, will decide, what do I believe? And normally they would do it in sort of consultation with us. What do I believe that people want to rent the software for? And should it be on a daily basis or weekly basis or whatever? And then they will set a price, and then you can access the application. And you will normally get a trial period, which will then be much shorter than a traditional trial period. I mean, not the 15 to 30 days, because then kind of shoot ourselves in the foot. But you may get a trial period of an hour or something like that. So at least you can get a feel for, is this a quality piece of software? So you can play around with it for now, for example. If that is the case, if that's what the publisher has decided, then you say, okay, this looks good. I want to pay the $7 and then rent this application for, say, 24 hours. And again, there's a big difference between, say, $7 and $60, right? It's a little bit like apps. I mean, if you buy an app to your Android or iPhone, and it only costs $3, $4, $5, and it's not what you want, it's not the end of the world. You pay $6 for a piece of software that really was not what you wanted.
So the vendor determines the amount of time and the cost.
Yes. It's their software, after all. It's their income. We always have a discussion with them or dialogue on what makes the most sense for that certain given application, but they're the ones who ultimately decide.
You're giving this added functionality to the vendors. What does it cost the vendors to have this functionality?
So the technology that's go behind here, that's been developed here, has actually been developed over several years now, and a lot of you know, hours have gone into it. It's very sophisticated technology. The way it works is that when a software publisher or a vendor has an application they want online, they come to us. We then take that application. We just need access to the exit file, the executable file. We don't need access to any source code ever. That's something the publisher
really?
Like to hear.
That's their IP.
Yeah, exactly. They don't really want to give that out.
No, but you don't even need access to their intellectual property. Gosh.
No. We do not need access to any source code at any point in time. So all we need is really an executable file. We will then take that and we run through our conversion process. And it typically takes about 48 hours. Again, that's sort of an average. We will then send it back to the publisher. They will be able to test it in detail and play around with it. They're not happy with the way it works and the way it performs. We go our separate ways, or we try and talk about what can be done, and they won't have to pay anything. If they are happy with the way it works, we then host it and we put it online, and that then they pay $995 for that. So that covers all our work of getting the application online, including hosting and support for 1 year.
Wait,
and again,
that's a one-time. $995 per year.
Yes.
Once, and then you.
So per year, it's a fee you pay per year.
And that's not a setup fee. That's the entire fee.
It's the setup fee, and it's one that's it gives you access or gives you the service for 1 year, and then it needs to be paid again a year. But I mean, what we often do is basically negotiate individual agreements with the publisher based on. How many titles do they have, the popularity of the titles, how much marketing do they want to do themselves, are they able to add event button to their site, and so on. Of course, we have been interested in that also. So in many cases, there are ways around this fee.
It seems very reasonable.
We think so, too. I mean, it's $9.95 is not even close to cost recovery for us. And where we make our money is then on a revenue sharing agreement, similar to what's known from app stores and portals and affiliates. And again, that's negotiated the same way. So
you're making your revenue on sharing the income from the people who are using your service, which
yes.
is additional income that vendor wouldn't have had previously.
Yeah.
Because basically you're capturing the people who would have abandoned either the download or would have abandoned at the purchase.
Yes, exactly. And the people who don't want to pay $40, $50, $80, $100 for a piece of software that they don't use that frequently, who need something right here, right now, that is still quality. Because the thing is, I mean, most people will, again, like I started by saying, I think the internet to some degree and software overall, I think all of us have unfortunately become a little bit cheap, right? There is a reluctance to pay for software, and it seems to be acceptable to just use private versions or freeware or shareware and so on.
But not in a business environment.
Not in a business environment, no, but from an end user point of view.
Because that's another thing, too, that a lot of PCs, people are not able to do downloads. I keep getting, I'm at actually the rooz.com site, and there is an automatic interaction that keeps opening up.
Yeah, top chat window.
In public areas where there might be PCs available, you can't do a download. Now, and the thing was, you're getting around the download, but they would still have to have, Ruse would still need to be installed on each machine that I want to access the software to rent.
Yeah, you need to install the plugin one time. That's correct.
So I just am suggesting another market opportunity.
Yeah.
To the businesses that provide those public machines, having Ruse already installed in them.
Yeah, I mean, there are also things we look
like
at.
Like the kiosk.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we're also looking at something, see how we can get it embedded with different partners and so on to sort of spread the, make rules more available on more machines. I mean, right now it's been installed by more than 550,000 people, so it's pretty decent growth, and that's basically done without any marketing whatsoever. We expect to exceed 2 million users by the end of this year, so of course, it makes it easier for everyone, the more users get this installed.
I was with a startup. We were thinking of all the different business cases before broadband was available and how to distribute software. That's really my excitement with what you're doing.
Right, great.
The question about the big vendors, the types of software that people might need to use on a one-time basis would be things like PowerPoint, would be things like, as you mentioned, for photos, for video, for presentations, for a presentation or for school, but they wouldn't need to own it over time. So do you have relationships yet with those big vendors or with alternative software that provides those kinds of solutions?
We have very active dialogue going on with, I would say, around 30 different publishers right now. Our focus is right now on the multimedia segment, so anything to do with photo and video, graphic designs and so on, because it's a fairly big market. There are a ton of titles out there. It's quite a crowded space. A lot of the titles are good, but don't really make that much money after all, because they kind of drown amongst competitors and so on. And that list also includes really the ones who are amongst the biggest to customers and publishers that are quite a bit smaller. So it's going to be sort of a wide variety of different titles in that segment we're going to get online. But it's not, I mean, this is kind of the first segment we are tackling right now. Again, we have some 25 titles online already with payment, and that's titles like, for example, Typing Master is a pretty well-known title that's on there. A title like XMind, which is a sort of productivity mind mapping application, very good. That's on there. We have a bunch of different games. We have.
Let me stop you right there with gaming. So I'm not a gamer. It didn't come immediately to mind. But I can definitely see people who are into games, and I don't know how expensive they are, but to be able to rent a game, that would certainly be something
yep.
I can see if I had young visitors. I wanted to keep them busy,
yep,
but I
exactly.
didn't want to keep that game on my machine.
Well, games make also a lot of, I mean, now both games and traditional software make sense. on our platform. Actually, most of the titles there right now are games, a lot of, including also a lot of free games. But we certainly also have games that you can rent, and some of them are really just fairly cheap games. You can rent them for about $1 a day. Some of them you can rent for about $1.50 for a full week, which is very easy. So it's basically just for leisurely gaming. Again, if it's not really the game you wanted, it's not the end of the world, because it's really a small payment. But yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Again, for these kinds of games, you get very short trial, I think 10 minutes on average, so you just get a feel for what it's like, and you play around a little bit, and you say, okay, I'm happy to spend that dollar just renting this game and have some fun for a Saturday afternoon, or, you know, have your kids play a game for Saturday afternoon instead of going down to the store and buying a game for $20-$30.
And the same with productivity software.
Yeah.
It's really something that you need to play with to know whether it's going to work or not. It's not something that just reading about it or even getting people's recommendations. You have to have the direct experience to see how quick your learning curve will be.
Yeah, yes. I mean, some of the productivity software is, of course, a little more tricky. We try to get the more sort of easy-to-use applications online, so you can still offer a fairly short trial, and people can feel confident they can actually learn it, and then, of course, they'll be more likely to rent it.
Excellent. And also educational software.
Educational software, again, we have a couple of titles on there in education. Again, Typing Master, for example, as I mentioned, is one very popular typing application. Couple of other typing applications we're getting online. We worked with a school here in Denmark last year about getting some of the applications online for them, because they distribute to a lot of different schools, and we have seen generally fairly good interest from the education sector as a new way of distributing software and make it more accessible to students. But any also education, again, of course, back to my earlier story about when I had that paper. It really is often, if you think about that, very often situation where you just need something real quick, whether it's an image resizer that's good, or if it's an application that can do a nice SWOT model for strategy paper and so on, right? And often you end up spending time Googling, again, because I think the internet has made us cheap, I guess. I mean, I still remember the case where I end up writing that strategy paper, and I probably spent 30 minutes Googling for a free application. And again, my point is just, if that application has been available for rent, for $5 for a day, I would have to have done it in a heartbeat, but that was not an option. So it's this sort of impulse purchase. You need something, you need it right now. You don't want to have to bother with the lengthy, long installations and finding it on your desktop. You want it available right now. You want to not pay a whole lot of money for it. You want something to solve your problem right now. You want something to entertain you right now. Small purchase.
And it offers the same performance when running the same software from a CD, and I was just looking at the technology comparison page,
mm-hmm.
comparing the different languages, the software responsiveness, the speed, and the technologies that a developer would use to get his software application running in a browser. A need to have a visual to be able
right.
to. This is a visual that speaks to me. Whenever there's a matrix comparison of data, that speaks to me.
I think a lot of people are like that.
So backing up, we jumped right in. What does Rooz mean? How did the name come about? Rooz.com, and also the logo looks like a brain on top of a tree trunk. What is the significance of that?
The name really doesn't mean anything. I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, everyone likes a five-character name because they're easy to remember, and if it's one syllable, great, even better, right? Thomas, again, as the founder, he came up with this name a couple of years ago because he was, again, one of the things that I've been talking about is basically it's rental or it's pay-per-use, if you like. And he was thinking pay per use, and then I guess it rhymed with Rooz, and said, okay.
Pay per use.
And Rooz is many, many times I've got his name on the phone. However, what we have noticed is that once people see him, once they do remember the name. So we think it's fairly catchy, and people remember it. It doesn't really mean anything.
It's interesting because I thought it was not an English word. And
okay, no. Five levels and also a domain that was available. Perfect. And in terms of the logo, I mean, we have a slogan that's a make software grow, because we really believe that software can do a lot of good things for people overall. We think also software could actually grow. And we also think that
people could grow by using more software. So if we can make software grow in an intelligent way, we may actually just after all, and maybe a little bit of a bold statement now, but maybe we even make the world a better place. And that's kind of what we try to collapse with the logo of the tree. If you think about it, software can really do a lot of things for a lot of people. There's a problem with access to software generally, and generally we certainly also have to help solve that.
If you're interested in hearing more about the technology of Rooz, go to the website at www.rooz.com. They have a great online chat that opens up that you can ask any question.
Yep. To make a point of the fact that what we are doing at the moment is partnering up with the software download portals, because if you think about it, they, you know, no matter whether big or, no matter if they're big or small, in essence, they offer the same thing to the user, and that is simply just a way to go through an additional download, get a trial, pay for the full price, whatever. It's basically, some people like the portal with the red color, some people like the portal with the green color, some people like the brand installer, all these kind of things. But what we're doing is partnering up the portals because they also believe that there could be a market out there for something like this. So we are expecting to go live with the first portal in about a month or so, who will actually add a rent button, whether it's going to be rent or run online or just rent, we don't know yet. But that means you will actually be able to go in, you'll be able to find applications on that given portal. We cannot mention the name yet, but you will be able to find the application that's important. You can simply just rent and run directly in your browser.
Excellent.
In addition to that, we are in discussion with a number of portals also. So we are expecting to be live on several portals during this year. Speaking of, we generally don't think there's been too much. Yes, there's been talk about rental of software here and there, but it's never really taken off. And you know, there are some subscription models and so on, and I guess they're working okay for a few companies out there. But the whole rental idea has never really taken off. But we are seeing increasing amount of interest both from publishers and from sort of more established players. And we're actually pretty proud also to comment that we've been invited to talk at Digital Rivers annual conference. For
Digital Rivers. So they have been at the forefront of this subscription model.
Yeah.
They've been around because back when I first got into product management and was working with bringing software to the web, Digital River was just starting.
Mm-hmm.
And they certainly have been at the forefront of this whole subscription and this whole rental and the whole e-commerce aspect that the vendors were not dealing with early on.
Right. They have done a lot of things for this industry, but they also see that possibly a change is needed. So we've been invited to talk on their Globalocity conference in Los Angeles next month, May 15th, where Thomas Peterson, our CEO, will go and talk about the topic of software rental per hour per day, a new mega trend for SMB software publishers, ? Give an educational talk on how we see the world and how this could change. A lot of things. Show some demos. And
thank you so much, Jesper, for joining me.
No, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity. It's great to be on the talk.
We will be now watching Rooz.com. Again, it's at www.rooz.com. Appreciate your taking the time at this beginning of your conquering how software rental is being done.
Thank you, Cindy. I really appreciate the opportunity. Thanks for having me.
Okay. This is Cindy Solomon with the Global Product Management Talk. This has been Startup Talk Radio. Please join us weekly for our Global Product Management Talk broadcast and Twitter chat using the hashtag #ProdMGMTTALK, and visit our website at www.ProdMGMTTALK.com for speakers and topics.